From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavish Smiley. On today's program, Oscar winner Octavia Spencer talks about her latest film, Hidden Figures, and acting legend Denzel Washington discusses his big screen adaptation of the August Wilson play Fences. But first, despite the calls by some Republican senators to punish Russia for apparently trying to influence the 2016 presidential race, President-elect Donald Trump has said that, quote, having a good relationship with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing, close quote. So, will Donald Trump continue to clash with his party over foreign policy issues, and what challenges will he face once he's in the White House? Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. His latest book is called A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. Good to have you on, Richard. Let me jump right in by asking you this, I guess, as a starter. If the world is in disarray now, what was it for the last 8 years?
Well, it's been moving in that direction. I think it's cumulative. Look, it's now, 25, 26 years since the end of the Cold War, Tavis. About the same amount of time since the world came together to deal with the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. And over this quarter century, I think things have gotten worse. I think in the last 8 years, in some ways in contrast to the 8 years that preceded it, the problem was not so much what the United States did, but often what it failed to do. And I think when history is written about Barack Obama's presidency in the foreign policy sense, it'll be mainly critical of him, again, for acts of omission. I think history will probably be more critical of his predecessor for acts of commission, above all the Iraq War.
I wrote this down, Richard, because I want to get it right. You tweeted this, and I quote, quite possible first overseas crisis confronting Trump administration will not involve Russia, China, North Korea, ISIS, or Iran, but Venezuela, close quotes. Everybody's talking about China, to be sure. Why Venezuela?
Well, I don't think it'll be China unless we trigger it. China's not looking for a crisis. They're focused on their economy, which is slowing down. They're focused on their big party Congress coming this October. Again, they really want continuity. Venezuela worries me because you essentially have the implosion of governmental power. It's lost most of its legitimacy. It's a failing country, which is bizarre given that it's also got the greatest inheritance of oil of any country on the planet. This is the result of decades of mismanagement, and I just simply think or predict that at some point it's going to really become a failed state, and then the United States and its neighbors are going to have to figure out what to do about it.
How important, how critical is that nation state to us?
Well, it's important, but the United States is largely self-sufficient in energy, but it's important because of the energy. It's important because of its situation in the region. But it's actually the one exception. Let me just take a step back. What I think so interesting about this part of the world, Tavis, mm-hmm. is how good it largely looks. If you look at the Western Hemisphere, put aside Venezuela, put aside some problems, say, with drug cartels or the like in places like Mexico or Central America. But by and large, this part of the world, it looks more democratic, more market-oriented. You don't see nuclear proliferation. You don't see terrorism. You don't see a whole lot of geopolitics in the way, say, that you do in the Middle East or Europe or Asia. So all things being equal, the good news is that Venezuela is something of an outlier.
It is something of an outlier, and yet I'm curious as to whether or not how you think the Trump administration will deal with Venezuela. We know the relationship or the lack thereof that existed between Chavez and George Bush. We know what Maduro has done during the Obama years. What's your sense of what the relationship will be like with Venezuela when Donald Trump takes office? I hear you laughing. I hear you laughing already.
I'm laughing already. I don't have the slightest idea. I'm not sure Mr. Trump or the people around him have the, a real idea. I doubt this is at the top of their inbox, which, by the way, is piled awfully high. Historically, this has been a part of the world which is often left to more junior officials, say an assistant secretary of state. I think the real question will be what we're prepared to do in concert with some of Venezuela's neighbors. I don't think it's a big unilateral question, and it's not through an organization like the Organization of American States The real question is working, say, with the Argentinas, the Brazils, the Chiles, and others, the regional heavyweights, whether the United States can fashion a policy that would help Venezuela make a political transition. And I think that's essentially going to be the question that will ultimately face this administration. What they're going to do, I haven't the faintest idea.
Before I move on, since you said you have not the faintest idea, what you do know is that Donald Trump reached out to you a number of times during the campaign. What you do know is he had some nice things to say about you. What I don't know is whether or not any of that means you're going to join the Trump administration.
Well, no one's been asking. I've got a great life and a great job here. Let me just say, if I'm asked by them, or if I had been asked by Secretary Clinton, if she had won, I think you've always got to look at the question of whether their conception of the job you're being offered is one you're comfortable with, and more important, whether you think you're in political alignment and intellectual alignment on the big issues. And if I were to be asked, and again, I'm not predicting I will be, I haven't been, but if I were to be asked, that's the sort of set of conversations we would have here.
Let me move on, though, to a guy who has been asked to join the administration, who has said yes, and all eyes are on not just him, but all of these nominations that are making their way now through the Senate, through Capitol Hill. Let me ask you specifically and first and foremost about Rex Tillerson. First of all, what did you make of the nomination of the former CEO of ExxonMobil to be the next Secretary of State? And how do you think this process is going to go for him? That is to say, the nomination process.
Well, again, this is someone who has a large amount of experience and a lot of what I would call ground truth. Major oil companies are operating all over the world. They know a lot about the situations there. Rex Tillerson has that after four decades of experience. And clearly Donald Trump, a businessman himself, likes the idea of somebody with a big business background coming in as Secretary of State. Whether he gets through the confirmation process or not, I don't have a crystal ball. I hope he does. As someone who thinks he would bring some valuable skills to the job. But let me make what I think is a more important point. If he gets through the process, or if he doesn't, whoever gets through the process, what's essential, Tavis, in addition to whatever this individual brings to the job, what might even be more important is whether Donald Trump is prepared to do what's necessary to help this person succeed. And by that I mean there can't be any daylight perceived between the President of the United States and his Secretary of State. When Jim Baker, who was George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president, when he was Bush's Secretary of State, everybody knew that when Baker spoke, he had Bush 100% behind him. So whether, assuming it's Rex Tillerson, people have got to know that. When he travels around the world, when he speaks out, he is speaking for this president, he is speaking for this administration.
Of course, the problem with that, as you well know, Richard, is that on any given day, any given moment, Donald Trump is likely to tweet something. So I ask you, no joking at all here, seriously, how, I hear you laughing, but seriously, how much trouble is Donald Trump going to get himself in, get this country in, and get whoever his Secretary of State will be, assuming Mr. Tillerson is that person to be approved by the Senate, how much trouble is he going to get into, to your point about being on the same page, with Trump tweeting whatever comes to his mind any hour of the day?
Well, again, you know, a lot depends upon the content, and it is a way of reaching people directly in this country and around the world without the filters of government or media. So I get the upside, but the downside is it can complicate life, it can create gaps, it can surprise people. You wouldn't want to have your Secretary of State walking out of a meeting only to be surprised by the traveling media. What do you have to say in reaction to this or that tweet? So what I would hope is that the president will dial it down or just be mindful that every time he sends out a tweet, it has consequences because now he speaks not just for himself, but you know, he will be speaking in a couple of days for this country of our 320 million people, which has an outsized role in the world.
I want to go into this book in just a second. Before I do that, one last question about the nomination specifically of Mr. Tillerson. You said a moment ago you hope that he will be confirmed. My question, if I can push back a bit, is why is a corporate CEO the best person to be Secretary of State? Why is that back? What qualifies a corporate CEO to be a good Secretary of State?
Well, it's not any corporate CEO, but again, someone who's got operations all over the world, has a lot of experience. You've run something which gives you a little bit of management and leadership. And the first order instinct of this president is to have somebody like that. And I think it's important that presidents have secretaries of state they feel comfortable with. So all of that seems to me that he brings to this job some serious capabilities. Look, I'm not going to sit here and say there aren't question marks. Obviously, you know, the committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, will have all sorts of questions, or will have had them about Russia. And that there's also a difference between being successful in the private sector and being successful in the public sector. And we've seen over the years that some people have made that transition better than others. So I can't sit here and predict perfection in the job, but it seems to me this is someone who's a heavyweight and brings an awful lot of global experience to this position.
In this new text, A World in Disarray, you call for a World Order 2.0. Tell me more.
Okay, well, let me just take one step back. World Order 1.0 is the one we've been living with for a long time, literally for centuries, and this is the idea that of sovereignty. That two things, that no government should use military force to change the borders of any of its neighbors. And secondly, what goes on within a country's borders are largely the province, the responsibility of that country alone. And that served us fairly well, not perfectly, because obviously it's been violated, but that idea has been pretty good. What I'm arguing is that in this era of globalization, this is necessary but not sufficient. That what goes on inside countries increasingly has implications for everybody else. Nothing is really local anymore. Terrorists inside one country can act against another. Obviously, we've seen in cyberspace, hackers can act that way. If disease breaks out in some country, it can spread beyond its borders, infect people all over the world. Climate change, if some country has a lot of coal-burning electricity plants, that will create problems not just in terms of air pollution, but that will contribute to global climate change and maybe help raise sea levels halfway across the world. So what I'm arguing is that we need to have a new operating system for the world. I like to call it World Order 2.0, where sovereign states don't simply have the benefits of sovereignty, but also now have obligations. And what I think the United States ought to be doing is talking to other governments, but also to the heads of big companies, to the heads of NGOs and others, about how we organize this world to deal with these global challenges that no one country can deal with on its own. And the reality is, again, that they don't respect borders. That's the kind of foreign policy we increasingly have to think about.
What's your concern, to the extent that you have some, and I think you do, given what I read in the text, between the U.S. economy and this world order?
Well, I think the good news is the U.S. economy will likely grow at a bit faster rate, and that will give us some of the resources we need to play a leading role in the world. My biggest concern is probably the broad opposition to trade agreements, and we saw that it's actually probably the only issue that Senator Sanders, Secretary Clinton, and Mr. Trump all agreed on. And we no longer have now the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have brought together, more than 40% of the world's economy. So we're losing the economic benefits, but we're also losing the strategic benefits of global trade agreements. So that really concerns me. The other thing about the United States is debt, that I'm worried about. As interest rates go up, it's going to cost us more to pay the interest on the debt we already have. If we start doing fiscal stimulus, which, you know, there's an argument we should for infrastructure and other things, again, we're going to jack up the debt. And I don't see any signs so far we're willing to tackle entitlements, Social Security, disability, Medicare, Medicaid. That's a toxic brew. We've got to find a way to deal with our debt before it gets so great it either crowds out all of the forms of useful spending, or we find ourselves vulnerable to markets or to what some central banker in a hostile country wants to do.
To your point about trade, Richard, how concerned then are you about Mr. Trump's position on trade?
Well, I am concerned, but again, what worries me is not just Mr. Trump here. It worries me that a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats, that what used to be a bipartisan consensus after World War II, or even in some ways before World War II, that got us through decades and decades and contributed to stability and contributed to economic growth, this consensus seems to have frayed. So the question is, how do we rebuild it? And it's going to take not just vigorous enforcement of trade laws. It's going to mean more education and training for workers whose jobs have been eliminated. It's probably going to mean more portability of various types of social help. It might mean certain types of floor on wages. So I think we're going to have to think really hard, because, by the way, the problem, as you know, Tavis, is not simply going to be trade. Mm-hmm. It's going to be innovation. When driverless vehicles become common, we're going to lose millions of jobs. Well, what happens to the people in those jobs? What happens to the people who would have gone into those jobs? I actually think as a society, this is going to be one of the biggest, if not biggest, challenge we're going to face, which is going to be the loss of jobs and how do we provide productive employment for a large number of Americans.
What's your sense of how Mr. Trump has handled or not handled, as it were, his interaction with heads of states? There's been so much written about the phone calls he's made, the kind of conversations he's had, again, the kind of tweets he's put forth, making statements to or about other countries, conversation with other foreign leaders. How do you see the way he's engaging the heads of these other states?
Well, yeah, the diplomatic word would be it's unconventional. I think there's a difference between Donald Trump, the candidate, Donald Trump, the president-elect, and Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States. And as Donald Trump transitions to be the 45th president of the United States at noon on January 20th, I think then he's got to be much more mindful of these kinds of interactions. I think there's a strong case to be made for the United States being predictable, for being reliable, for being really careful where it breaks new ground. We don't want to in any way confuse our allies, and to a large extent they actually need to be reassured because they're banking so much of their own safety and security and prosperity on us. So my own view is we've got to be very careful in all the things we say publicly, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or in conversations. And I don't think that's the way normally to break new policy. I think there is a case for doing things in private, working them out, and only go public when you're really ready for it.
I haven't had a chance to ask you about this, but everybody else has been talking about it. Now that I've got you, I want to ask you, Richard, your take on this entire brouhaha. Okay. About Israel, what the Obama administration did or didn't do, what Donald Trump then tweeted, what Benjamin Netanyahu has had to say. We all know the story. What's your read going forward, at least, on what's going to happen between the U.S. and Israel and that relationship?
Look, I would not have voted for this resolution at the U.N. I don't like the idea of trying to sort out the Israeli-Palestinian problem or conflict there. That said, I think there are issues about Israeli behavior. There are obvious issues about Palestinian behavior. What I'm going to say is probably going to surprise you. You may not like it. I would not make this a priority for the new administration. I simply don't think the pieces are there. John Kerry spent an awful lot of hours and devoted a lot of miles to it. I just don't think this situation is teed up, or to use my favorite diplomatic term, ripe, R-I-P-E, mm-hmm. for progress. What I would do, though, is talk a lot to the Israelis and the Arabs about how we deal with some regional crises, including Iran. And there, my recommendation is not in any way to tear up the Iran nuclear agreement, but rather to focus on two things. I would focus on how we deal with Iran's push for power and influence around the region. And secondly, I would start the conversation sooner rather than later, Tavis, about what we do when the current Iran nuclear agreement begins to expire. What do we put in its place? Because we can't want to see Iran introduce a nuclear weapon to the region, say, in a decade. Well, how do we prevent that? The current agreement, whatever its strengths and weaknesses, is time limited. And this administration had better begin the process of thinking about what comes afterwards.
Far be it for me to push back on Richard Haass, but isn't that the problem with his administration, that they waited too late to engage the process in Israel and Palestine?
Again, I don't see the pieces to succeed with. I don't think the current situation is in the interests of Israelis or Palestinians. Don't get me wrong. By the way, though, if we did solve it, let's not kid ourselves, it wouldn't bring peace to Syria or Libya or Yemen or anywhere else. But it is of real importance to Israelis and Palestinians. As someone, though, who's worked, as a diplomat, I was the envoy to the Northern Ireland talks. I was the U.S. envoy to the Cyprus talks. I've been involved in Israeli-Palestinian talks. I've been involved in India-Pakistan talks. You've got to have some things to work with. You've got to have two sides that are, one, willing, and two, able to act, to make real compromises. And I'll be honest with you, I simply don't see that right now.
As I promised, this question now about President Obama's legacy. He's out in just a few days. What will be said by the historians years from now about what he did accomplish and what he did not accomplish?
I think in his foreign policy legacy, the critics will have the upper hand. I know for some people this is going to sound partisan, but I'm not partisan. I've worked for Democrats. I've worked for Republicans. I'm lucky enough to head a nonpartisan organization. I think that Mr. Obama's case will be seen as largely things he didn't do. Syria, obviously, the follow-up to the Libya invasion. He'll also probably come under some criticism for pulling all U.S. troops out of Iraq, for putting U.S. troops in Afghanistan on an arbitrary calendar. I think he'll get some better marks for the so-called rebalancing to Asia, but there, any credit will be diluted by the fact that the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement never got passed by the U.S. Congress, so the agreement never came into being. The Iran agreement's going to remain controversial. It'll have its critics. It'll have its supporters. He'll get some points for things like Cuba, but I think that's rather small. So I think overall, he is going to get criticized again, more for what he didn't do, and he'll be seen as someone who overreacted to the perceived flaws of his predecessor. And also, coming back to my basic book, some will blame him, some will not, but if you take this thing called the state of the world, say world order, what he handed off is substantially worse than what he inherited. And you can say it's not his fault, you can say it would have been worse without him, you know, that's for historians to argue about, but simply the cold objective reality is the level of disarray in the world is greater now than it was 8 years ago.
How much of that can you put at his feet, though?
Well, that's why historians earn a living. And I would put some of it at his feet, particularly in the Middle East. I would put a significant percentage at his feet there, again, for all the things he chose either to do or not to do. I think he'll also get a little bit of criticism for not doing more to build military capacity in Ukraine. But in other parts of the world, I think, you know, he'll get some better marks for some of the things he did in Asia, for U.S.-Indian relations, for Cuba. So like any president, it's going to be a mixed record. But my prediction is, or my own assessment is, mm-hmm. that the negatives will outweigh the positives when it comes to foreign policy.
Back to your new book, A World in Disarray. You're a patriot. I'm a patriot. I love patriots. Nothing wrong with patriotism, but there is something wrong, to my mind at least, when that patriotism morphs into nationalism. And I wonder what kind of trouble we're already headed for with a president whose slogan was to make America great again. There are a number of ways, of course, to read that. I guess what I'm asking you is specifically on this issue of nationalism as it relates to your new book, A World in Disarray, how do you read what box that puts us in for the next 4 years?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not ducking it. You know, you're right that things like nationalism have a good side and a bad side if it gets out of hand. Mm-hmm. It can become unilateralist. It can become xenophobic. I worry about populism as well. So I don't quite know how it's going to play out. You know, from where I sit, it's important that we accept the reality that we can't shape the world by ourselves. We also can't ignore the world. It'll unravel without us playing a large role. How we decide to partner with others is in some ways one of the biggest questions facing Donald Trump, or it would have been the same big question facing Hillary Clinton. So, mm-hmm. My own view is that the nationalism, we've got to be careful about it because it can get out of control. We're seeing elements of that in Europe. We're seeing elements of that here, and it can get destructive. A lot of the 20th century is a century, or it's a history, about where nationalism tended to get out of control. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously something we need to avoid.
But those nationalist tendencies that you just described that have taken root around the globe are the tendencies that Mr. Trump has celebrated, at least during the campaign. So unless you're right about the fact that we're going to see a very different Donald Trump as president than we saw on the campaign trail, the issue of isolationism ought to bother all of us, it seems to me.
Look, I can't sit here and predict what he's going to do. I don't know. I want to avoid two extremes. I want to avoid a United States that tries to remake the world in our image. I think that is folly. And I want to see a United States that avoids the worst elements of isolationism and protectionism, where we turn our back on the world. That's all. It's just as dangerous because bad things will happen and they're not going to stay there. They're going to come back and hurt us here.
His new text is called A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy in the Crisis of the Old Order. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The number one box office movie in the country is Hidden Figures, and it tells the story of three African-American women who were integral to NASA's Friendship 7 mission in 1962. This historic event made John Glenn the first American to orbit the Earth. Octavia Spencer plays one of the mathematicians, Dorothy Vaughn, NASA's first African-American supervisor. Before we get to that conversation, though, here's a clip from the film.
New assignment came down the pike.
Me?
Temporarily, yes. We need the IBM for Glenn's launch. The lead engineer says you're good with the cards, programming, and such.
What about the girls here?
Well, human computers can't calculate an orbital flight in the time we have. They'll stay put for now.
I'm not accepting reassignment unless I bring my ladies with me.
Excuse me?
We're gonna need a lot of manpower to program that beast. I can't do it alone. My gals are ready. They can do the work.
So can I just high-five you on that number one thing?
Thank you. We'll take it.
What do you make of beating out Rogue One?
I think the irony of the fact that this movie took 50 years to make about three women who helped get our astronauts to space and back home safely, and we are battling, or were battling, a movie about space was quite befitting.
That is kind of funny, isn't it?
It's pretty funny.
When you said a story 50 years ago, it is... Not that I'm supposed to know everything and not that you're supposed to know everything, but it is always humbling for me. In some ways, I just feel stupid and belittled when there's a story this powerful that I just don't know. And then when I come into the knowledge of it, it is so empowering, it is arresting. How did you take hearing about this story the first time?
Well, I'm equally embarrassed, but yeah. I don't take that onus because how do we know about it if it's not presented
to us? True enough.
And, you know, if you're not in those fields, if you're not inclined to know those things, you know, you won't.
Yeah.
For me, I thought it was historical fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, I had just done The Help.
Yeah.
And I was told that I would be meeting with the producer, Donna Gelati, who always picks these wonderful projects with strong roles for women. Mm-hmm. And when I met with her, I thought it was a work of fiction because I had never heard of these women.
Yeah.
And to find out that it was true, to Google it and see, you know, very little about Mary Jackson and mm-hmm. Dorothy Vaughn, but to see that Katherine Johnson had been given the Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama, it was bittersweet, but I also felt compelled at that moment to know that these women went largely unheralded for their contributions to the space race. Yeah. I knew I had to be a part of it.
So how fast and how fast did you and how far did you fall in loving Dorothy Vaughn?
I fell in love with Dorothy Vaughn when I got the script. I met on it 2 years ago, uh-huh. January.
Right.
And when I got, it was just a proposal at the time. And then a few months later, I got a script. And I fell in love with Dorothy Vaughn.
Yeah.
I mean, to have the mechanical inclinations, to have an engineer's brain wrapped in this quality woman who's a mom, who's a God-fearing woman, who was existing at a time when she was viewed as a second-class citizen, but that didn't bother her. She still did the work and mm-hmm. contributed in such a major way. Who wouldn't want to play her?
Yeah, yeah. You obviously are an Academy Award winner. I saw your friend
Viola
Davis win for Fences.
Yes.
And Tracy Ellis Ross wins for her TV show Black-ish. And you have this film that's number one at the box office with three black women as the leads. I don't want to colorize this, but clearly color is a part of it. Race is a part of it. How do you process this moment where these sisters are getting all this love?
You know what? I think with the current political climate, a lot of suppressed views have reemerged. Mm-hmm. And those who don't subscribe to those views are understanding that they have a voice that they have to use to speak out on behalf of all people and to educate their children in a way that will be more inclusionary so that we don't take 50 mm-hmm. A step back 50 years. So I see it as that. But you know, an Indian young man was on stage with an even smaller Indian mm-hmm. for Lion. I'm really encouraged. Mm. I'm really encouraged by what we're seeing happening.
Yeah. In the canon of the stuff you've already done, how does it feel to have played a real-life black female mathematician?
she's a superhero. Yeah. And I've never been offered, you know, one of the superhero shows where you get to wear tights.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had to wear tights.
Yeah.
And they
I must say, not to cut you off, but I must say that opening scene when you land on the ground under that car. Trying to fix that starter. I don't want to get the movie away, but the opening scene is worth the price of the admission. One of the opening scenes, just to see you slide from underneath that car. But I digress. Go ahead. You were saying about wearing tights.
Yeah. Well, she's a superhero to me. Yeah. And you know what? We need these images.
Yeah.
Young boys and girls need to know that they possess the inner workings to change the world. You don't need a cape and superpowers. Your brain, it all starts here and how you perceive yourself and your place in the world. And I think I would have dreamed a different type of dream. I'm a creative, but I would have dreamed a different type of dream for myself. But I do believe everything happens for a reason, because we are now meant to propel the story forward for the future generation of young women in STEM.
Yeah. Speaking of kids, you've written some children's books, haven't you? Yeah, tell me about the books, your children's books.
Ninja Detectives, Randy Rhodes' Ninja Detectives. I wanted a multicultural group. Some people were upset that my protagonist was a little white girl, but I knew that I wanted a young black boy, and I wanted to tell the story about a young girl being a leader. So I chose the two boys to be in her little group to be Latin and African American, because they don't see themselves in literature. And I wanted to make sure that young black boys saw themselves in literature, my literature.
Yeah. It is always interesting to me to hear an actor come on the show and say, so I read this thing 2 years ago. And then 2 years later, we get a chance to see it, fall in love with it. It becomes number one. But you guys obviously are so ahead of the process. That's my way of leading up to asking, so what are you working on now? What are you reading now that we're going to be celebrating you in a couple years from now?
Well, we're doing Madam C.J. Walker. Casey Lemons is
my hometown of Indianapolis.
It. She's doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to be doing that.
Yeah.
We're also doing a movie about Jonestown with Vince Gilligan is writing it, and Michelle McLaren is directing it. I'm just choosing projects that are multifaceted, and you know, Madam C.J. Walker's story is one that young...
You're playing her.
I'm playing C.J.
I love you already.
You know, I mean, she was a part of my dream.
Yeah.
So the fact that I get to play her is it's monumental.
Yeah, there's a wonderful theater in my hometown of Indianapolis that bears her name, the Madam C.J. Walker Theater.
Are you serious?
And I've spoken on that stage so many times at all kinds of events. The last time I was there for a fundraiser, I think. And so I've spoken on that stage so many times. I know her story so well. I know her offspring. And I've often wondered, why haven't they got around to telling her story?
Well, the time is now.
Yeah. And you're the right person to play it, too.
Well, I hope so. I'm excited. And I think Casey Lemons is a brilliant director
and
actress.
Yeah.
So I am thrilled that I'm going to get to work with her.
Yeah.
You know, it's a strange time. And I think people have to chart their course.
Yeah.
You have to determine how you want to be a part of the solution. And for me, it's about putting positive images out there. I have a film coming out, and people are going to have problems with it because I shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Some people will think that it is me playing some type of mammy. I've never played a mammy, and I won't play a mammy.
Right.
I have a problem with that.
Yeah.
What I do play is a best friend to, the movie's called Gifted, and I play a best friend to Chris Evans's character, and he basically inherits a daughter, a niece, that he has to take care of. And I think, you know, I had a wonderful extended family. And the reason why I chose to do that movie was because of the fact that it's an unconventional family.
Yeah.
I am pretty much a godmother to one of my dearest friends, her young Latin boys. I have an affront to people who, whenever they see a black woman having anything to do with child rearing, they call her mammy. I'm nobody's mammy. Nobody's mammy.
Well, that's on the record already, and the movie ain't came out yet.
Yeah.
So
I'm just telling you, I'm getting ready. And there are people that are upset that I'm playing God. It's like, it's just so funny, the things
How can I be mad at you playing God?
I know, Morgan Freeman played God, and there was
George Barnes played God.
And there was no uproar.
Everybody's played God.
Okay, but now that I'm playing God, you know, people are, you know, they have they're feeling a certain way about it. But, you know what? I can only do what I do.
Yeah.
And that's just be positive and try to put good work out there.
I tell you what I celebrate. What I celebrate is that you have succeeded to the point now where you have choices.
Yes.
And that you get to choose what you want to do.
Yes.
Which is so rare in this business.
It is very rare.
And what I especially love is that you're choosing to play roles like Dorothy Vaughn in Hidden Figures. That just tells a story about, and you know what I love about this? Two things. I'm out of time, but I just got, since you're here, I got to tell you this. What I love sitting in that movie was that here was a film about our people that showed characters that were complex, that were textured, that were layered. And I was just so into that, number one. Number two, obviously, they're characters that are not conventional.
Yes.
Not what you think of, and you think of black women, which I think was a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing I love the most, of course, is that it is a story that shows the role that black folk have played in weaving the narrative that is America.
Yes.
I think all the time about that Du Bois quote,
mm-hmm.
who Du Bois once asked, would America have been America without her Negro people?
It would have been a different America.
The country just wouldn't be.
It would be.
Without the contributions.
I agree. And here's the thing. We have always been what you see in Dorothy, Catherine, and Mary.
Yeah.
We've always been those people. It's just never been displayed on screen. And that's what I'm excited about, that people are now seeing that.
It's called Hidden Figures. It is a powerful, powerful story that you must see. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Our next guest, Denzel Washington, one of America's most acclaimed actors. His awards include 2 Oscars and a Tony for his portrayal of the character Troy Maxson in the Broadway revival of the play Fences by August Wilson. Fences has now been adapted for the big screen, and Denzel Washington directs and stars in it along with Viola Davis, who, of course, just won a Golden Globe for her work in the film. Before we start our conversation with Mr. Washington, first a scene from Fences.
Oh, woman, come here. Look here, Bruno. When I first met this woman, I got out that place there. Hitch up my pony, saddle up my mare. There's a woman out there for me somewhere. I looked at here, looked at there, saw Rose, and I latched on to her. I latched on to her, and I told her, I'm gonna tell you the truth. I latched on to her and told her, baby, I don't want to marry. I just want to be your man. Rose told me, tell him what you told me, Rose.
I told him if he wasn't a mankind, then move out the way so the mankind could find me.
That's what she told me. You're in my way, you're blocking the view, move out the way so I can find me a husband.
How long ago you filmed this?
I don't remember.
A year ago?
No, not even a year. Not even a year.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
8 months.
Okay, 8 months. So the clip is playing, and he's sitting here all these months later reciting his lines.
But remember, I edited the picture.
I know
so
you
I'm
did.
Watching it over
yeah,
and over.
Yeah, I know. But what's amazing about that to me, though, is what happens when August Wilson's words get in your spirit. When I saw this film, and first of all, let me just start by saying thank you. I talked to 1,000 friends who've all seen this film, and we all love the film. And I think there is this, as I've talked to my friends at least, there is this overwhelming desire just to say thank you to you. I know people run into you on the street and hotels and stuff, but there's a debt that's owed to you for actually putting this thing on film.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's the first time August's stuff has been given this kind of treatment. So to put it on film is a beautiful thing. I say all that to say that as many times as I've seen this play, and I was, of course, saw you on Broadway in it, when I saw it on film, his words, the power of his words hit me in a different way. It made me appreciate his stuff even more, the words.
Because we're here.
Yeah.
You know, in a play, you're whatever, depending upon what ticket you got.
What seat you got, yeah.
Exactly. You watch the whole thing at once, and you decide where you're going to look, usually based upon who's speaking.
Right.
But in a film, the decisions are editorial, and you're this close.
Yeah.
You're very close, so you feel like you just feel it's just closer. It's more effective.
Yeah.
And I took the luxury of spending time with people when they're alone. Like there's a scene when Troy walks out and he knocks all the stuff off the table, and now we're alone with Rose. So we didn't have those moments in the play. You know, he'd walk out and the lights would go down, but here we stay with. We get to feel what Rose is feeling.
Yeah. What do you hope people come away with, or put another way, are forced to wrestle with when they have to marinate on his words?
I always say this. It depends. When people ask me, what do you want people to get from this?
Right.
I always say it depends upon what they bring to it.
Sure.
Some are Troy. Some are the sun. I've met people. We've been doing screenings all around and Q&As. And one screening, I like to come in and sit the last 5 minutes and just get a feel of the audience
sure.
before we do the Q&A. And I saw an empty seat, and I sat down, and it was a guy who was really Irish guy, I think, a redhead guy, white guy, and was really, he was struggling.
Yeah.
You know, and I leaned over and said, "You okay?" He's like, "Yeah, you know." I said, "Is that you up there?" I said, "Is that you up there?" He says, "My father." I said, "Well, are you the son?" He said, "No, my brother was the son. My brother was a great athlete, and his father." So, you know, it's universally, it's specifically an African American family, yeah. but the themes are universal.
I'm glad you said that. What do you make of that? What do you make of the fact that August wrote something that was so specific, and yet, to your point now, I'm glad you gave me that example. Mm. It is so universal.
Well, I think if you try to please everybody, you don't please anybody.
Right.
So he wrote about what he wanted to write about this family.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the themes are universal. I mean, the specificity of it is what's so universal, what's mm-hmm. so effective. I mean, just the way Troy, because of his frustrations, the way he beats down his son and, mm-hmm. you know, just won't allow him to. And the son says what all sons want to say, just because you didn't have a chance, you know. And then he takes it a little further, says, mm-hmm. "You're afraid I was going to be better than you."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had the honor of working out in the same gym you work out. We box in, so I see you at the gym a lot. And we talked about this while you were working on and editing and all that. But I did not know. I don't know how I missed this. I did not know that August actually wrote the screenplay for this.
Yeah, I mean, the screenplay. If there's 25,000 words in the screenplay, 24,900 of them are August Wilson's.
Right.
So I had to add little things here, and it was also a deciding where scenes were going to take place.
Right.
Because in the play, they're all in the backyard.
Sure.
We have to present it to the audience. So we obviously moved in the house and to the front of the house, and,
right.
you know, and then on to really one of the big decisions that I had to make was, or that was nervous about, was bringing Rose to his job.
Right.
Because that was never in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big mm-hmm. statement, and it can tweak the balance of things against Troy, because she's making the extra effort. She's
right.
going out of her way, and he still rejects her.
With what amount of trepidation does one approach even tweaking August's work, given that you had to put some stuff in that wasn't in the play?
I've read different versions of it, so there are longer versions of the play.
Right.
His original version is much longer, mm-hmm. or a lot longer. So there were cuts made anyway,
right.
long before me. So, you know, I have to do what's best for the film.
Yeah. So it's one thing to write something that is specific, D. It's another thing to write something that is both specific and universal. But it's another thing to write something that is specific, universal, and accessible.
Mm.
And I can tell you now, I didn't have the nerve to tell you when you were working on it. I can tell you now that it's done and you did it brilliantly, that what worried me most is whether or not you could make on film August's stuff accessible. Because as you know, the stage is one thing, film is something else. And the stage in the minds of a lot of people, especially August's work, can be labeled highbrow by people who don't get it, don't want to have the patience to wrestle with it. Were you ever afraid that you would have trouble making it accessible?
I didn't, no.
Yeah.
No, I didn't think about that, or I didn't.
My point is this. When you watch August's stuff, you got to wrestle with that thing, man. It's not a bunch of action. I mean, you ain't got a bunch of stuff flying through the air, a bunch of pyrotechnics. I
mean, you got to listen?
Yes,
oh,
that's what I mean.
Imagine that.
Yeah, I know. But you got to focus.
Which is why I started the film in black.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So that you had to lean forward and listen.
Yeah.
I did that on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, so that you would listen.
What made you feel that people in an era where our attention spans are like that, even faster than that, would sit, be patient, take it in, listen? That's a risk to take in the movie.
Because when people are thirsty, they need water.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you know, they need water. And it just reels you in. At first, it seems like entertainment or just fun. And I remember Kenny Leon, who directed us on Broadway. Kenny said, "You know, Troy is the TV. Mm-hmm. They don't have a television. Troy's the television. Mm-hmm. Friday night, he gets the same pint. He tells the same lies. Mm-hmm. They know he's going to tell them same punchlines, and they all, you know, it's the ritual."
Yeah. When did you know that you wanted to or were going to do this as a film? When did you commit yourself to that?
When they made me. Yeah. I mean, Scott Rudin, one of the producers, asked me 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And I read the screenplay, and I realized I hadn't read the play.
Right.
So I read the play and said, Troy Maxson, 53. Mm-hmm. Well, I was 55 when I read it. And I'm thinking, because when I saw it in the 80s, I'm looking at it through Corey's eyes because I was younger. So I'm thinking I was too young for Troy. But when I read it and said 53, I was like, oh, I better hurry up. So I called Scott Rudin and said, I want to do the play.
Yeah. I asked that because I was just curious about how much thought time you put into, how much time you had to wrestle with what you wanted it to look like on film.
Well, you know, filmmaking is a collaborative process. Mm-hmm. You put some of the best people around you, director of photography, editor, and you all work together, and you want to inspire them. And so I don't think, I know enough, I've been around long enough to know that I don't think I know everything. Mm-hmm. So I put the best around me, let them do what they do. Ultimately, I got to make the final decision, but just let the best do what they do. Let Viola go. Let Stephen Henderson go. You know, I'm going to start directing now.
Yeah.
Oh, Viola, I think, you know, I think you should.
Well, you are the director, though. I mean, that's
well,
what,
and
yeah.
I did direct.
Yeah.
Or I, you know, but the smartest thing I did as a director was to take Michael T. and Stephen and Viola and who am I leaving out? Russell.
Sure.
The guys that did it, you know, the core group that did it on Broadway to take it to film.
Yeah. After you finish all this award season for Fences, what's next?
I have a script called Inner City, and I play this lawyer who's very, very bright, but has social issues.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about that. It's sort of like Asperger's or in that world. So I'm just starting to get into that world.
Yeah. If my memory is correct, the last time you played a lawyer, you were pretty brilliant in that.
Which one?
Philadelphia.
Was that the last time?
You played a lawyer since then?
I don't remember. I spent that money.
You know,
I don't know. That was 1990. That was 22 years ago. I may have played a lawyer since.
I'm trying to think.
I don't know.
Yeah, your people are here. Did you play a lawyer since then? Anybody remember anyone? Bueller. I think I'm right about this.
Mm. Yeah. Good news is I didn't need a couple of lawyers.
The film is Fences, starring, directed by one Denzel Washington, a powerful, powerful piece of work. I close where I began. I'm just thankful that he saw to do this. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.